got a sprain or an itch, pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky. I call up and ask me, Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. For many years, low-carb diets have been recommended for people with diabetes. But the real question for many diabetics is just how low is low enough?
How low can you go? How low can you go? How low can you go? How low can you go?
To answer that, we really have to start with another question, and that is, what exactly is a low carbohydrate diet? That really varies from individual to individual.
Now, a new study reaffirms the previous research that a low-carbohydrate diet can help with blood sugar levels and triglycerides.
Not only that, a diet with fewer calories can also help reduce inflammation in the body, and we've talked about inflammation on many shows in the past. The problem is that the studies don't specify how many carbohydrates per day really constitute a low-carb diet.
Researchers recently reported that a reduced carbohydrate diet has helped with blood sugar levels and triglycerides in people with type 2 diabetes.
Remember, type 2 is the type of diabetes that usually starts when you're older and is not the same as type 1 diabetes, where the body produces little or no insulin.
The study was pretty simple, with 28 people with type 2 diabetes who were followed for a total of 12 weeks. For the first 6 weeks, they each ate the traditional high-carbohydrate diet, and then for the remaining 6 weeks, ate a lower-carbohydrate diet.
The lower-carbohydrate diet was also high in protein, moderate in fat, and included carbohydrates with a lower glycemic index. The results showed lowered blood sugar levels and A1C improved, and the participants' stored liver fat noticeably improved as well. According to the researchers, this confirmed the assumption that a diet with a reduced carbohydrate content really can improve patients' ability to regulate their blood sugar levels without loss of weight. Thus, they felt that these results allowed them to remove weight loss from the equation.
So what is the next step? That will be to create a larger and more controlled study to further illustrate the importance of carbohydrate reduction in the treatment of type 2 diabetes.
Still, we have not gotten the answer that we asked at the start of the show. How low is too low?
Remember that low carb does not mean no carb. It also does not mean that all carbohydrates are bad for you. So the question has become, is it a low-carb or just a lower-carb diet that should be recommended?
There is a big difference between these statements. I remember years ago when they came out with a, let's call it, diet peanut butter that called itself low-fat peanut butter. It should really have been called lower-fat. And if it's lower, lower than what?
There are 16 grams of fat in 2 teaspoons of peanut butter, and 12 grams in the reduced-fat peanut butter. Generally, around 50 grams of total fat per day is recommended.
If you like nut butters, almond butter may be a better choice, as almond butter is the highest in healthy fats, with about 3 grams more of heart-healthy monounsaturated fat per serving as compared to peanut butter, but less saturated fat, making it a great alternative. Well, getting back to the original question.
Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, meaning fatty liver disease not caused by alcohol intake, is a frequent comorbidity in people with type 2 diabetes. And if ignored, it can easily lead to liver swelling. cancer, organ failure, and pancreatitis.
Have you ever heard of foie gras? Well, it's a delicacy at many fancy restaurants. Essentially, it's duck liver that is super high in fat because those ducks were purposefully fattened and actually developed fatty liver disease themselves. According to one researcher, it is through diets high in heavily processed carbohydrates and sugary beverages that we're making ourselves the human version of foie gras. In other studies, the researchers found that a fatty diet negatively affects your gut's immune system, we've talked about that on other shows, and leads to the production of an antibody protein called IgA. Now, IgA is naturally produced by our bodies. It's needed to regulate the bacteria that live in our gut.
It acts as a defense mechanism that helps neutralize potentially dangerous bacteria that take advantage of changes to the environment, such as when we consume an imbalanced or fatty diet.
Inflammation also plays a key role in the development of diabetes and overall insulin resistance.
When we improve IgA levels through changes in diet, we help to prevent, reverse, and even treating type 2 diabetes, increasing these IgA-B cells or their products may help to control the type of bacteria in the gut.
The strict low-carbohydrate diet was introduced to the diabetes community mainly by Dr. Richard Bernstein, the author of Dr. Bernstein's Diabetes Solution. He has advocated a pretty severe low-carbohydrate diet, meaning that he even excludes non-starchy vegetables.
So, in recent years, the keto diet, which is similar to Bernstein's diet, has gained popularity. It encourages a total carbohydrate consumption of 20 grams of the net carbs per day. You can calculate net carbs by subtracting the carbs in daily dietary fiber from the total carbs consumed.
The effect is that the body begins burning more body fat for fuel. That results in ketones the entire body can use for fuel instead of glucose. Now, there are some caveats to this diet, since the human body will try to create glucose out of anything it can, since glucose, which is sugar, is the primary fuel source for the human body. And remember, your central nervous system needs glucose, even though many ketogenic diet books tell you that it doesn't.
This is why people with type 1 diabetes will find that during a keto diet, they will still need some insulin for meals high in protein and fat, but void of carbohydrates.
The real focus should be on eating more quality carbohydrates and reducing highly processed carbohydrates, and that includes, you know what I'm talking about, sugary beverages.
With people who stick to a ketogenic diet enough, you will see a reduction in triglycerides because of the drastic reduction in processed carbohydrates and usually a significant rise in LDL, which is the bad cholesterol.
Also on the weekly health news sites was an article about virtual reality devices to see if it could really help make chronic pain patients more comfortable. Some pregnant women are experimenting with VR headsets to ease the pain of childbirth. And in 2017, burn victims started using VR gaming to lessen the excruciating pain of having their bandages changed.
Now, new research from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center supports virtual reality as a safe and effective way to reduce severe pain in hospitalized patients.
Many patients nowadays are interested in reducing their need for drugs, so VR fits right in and just may provide us with a low-risk and easily tolerated option for pain relief. So like everything else in medicine, the proof is in the research. So to measure how well therapeutic VR reduces pain, researchers studied 120 patients pretty recently, actually between 2016 and 2017.
The participants had a range of medical conditions and experienced moderate to severe pain prior to using the VR headsets.
61 people were given a VR headset called the Samsung Gear Oculus headset. You may know about it. It's pretty common nowadays. It has access to 21 different immersive experiences in this research, such as a simulated helicopter tour over rugged Iceland, or a guided relaxation while looking at soothing ocean or mountain scenery. They then used the headsets during 3 10-minute sessions a day over the course of 48 hours.
The other 59 people watched television featuring guided relaxation, like yoga and meditation, along with poetry readings.
The results were pretty darn good.
On a scale of 1 to 10, the self-reported pain scores dropped by 0.46 points in the group that watched the television programming and 1.72 points in the patients who used the VR headsets.
Importantly, the patients with the most severe pain reported the greatest benefits from the VR headsets, with their pain scores dropping roughly 3 points. A drop of 2 or 3 points may not sound so good, but in the chronic pain relief arena, it is.
Maybe VR just helps distract people from their pain, but VR certainly mitigates people's pain, and it does it well.
Many health experts suspect that VR distracts people away from the pain that they're experiencing.
As we said, we still don't know why it works. At this time, something called the gate theory is most acceptable to researchers.
You know, we've talked about this on previous shows, but in a nutshell, it postulates that VR actually reduces the perception of pain by absorbing and diverting attention away from the pain, just as we just said previously.
When people are engaged in an immersive experience, they begin to tune out other stimuli, including their body's pain signals.
Now think about that for a moment. Maybe you injured yourself and were feeling the pain. Then all of a sudden you heard a crash. Maybe it was real, or maybe it was just on the TV. Anyway, for several moments you may have later noted that the pain disappeared for those few moments that you determined where the crashing sound came from.
Not only that, but new VR experiences often include relaxation techniques, such as guided meditations, which are important skills to help manage acute as well as chronic pain.
There's still a lot to learn about the possibilities of VR.
There are several more questions that need to be answered to better understand the full potential of VR in a clinical setting.
I can still remember an old game called Space Ace, where the player would have to make split decisions to save the hero from imminent death. I was playing it one day after injuring myself and I was hurting. I began playing it for longer and longer periods. Well, I had the acute pain, since the pain literally seemed to go away while I was in the midst of the game itself. So I can vouch for the effect of VR on pain.
Of course, we still need more studies to determine just what the effect of VR is on specific types of situations, such as after various surgical procedures, in surgical recovery, or as a help in reducing the long-term use of pain medication.
VR could even have various health effects with patients who are of certain personality types. In other words, some might respond better to VR solutions than others. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just 2 blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. You know, my grandson loves broccoli, but he also does not like onions.
She bought some broccoli. She brought it home. She's chopping broccoli.
I don't remember right now if he really likes asparagus or not. But new research suggests that people may find the taste of the bitter green vegetables more enjoyable if they actually eat them more often. So let's say that you do not like the taste of bitter green vegetables. Well, there is good news. The way they taste can improve the more frequently you eat them.
Our children, we may think we don't like the taste of something, but our tongues may not have made up their minds yet. Bitter, for example, is a complicated taste.
As another aside, coffee is thought to be bitter, but now 64% of Americans drink a cup of coffee every day, up from 62% in 2017 and the highest percentage since 2012. We have seemingly learned to enjoy the bitter taste of coffee.
A bitter flavor typically serves as a warning sign, as in if something tastes bitter, then it might be poisonous. Unfortunately, that includes some vegetables like broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, kale, radishes, and arugula.
Cabbage and kale, well, they taste so bad. Eating arugula makes me sad. Radishes, they're red and white, and cabbages cause dreams at night. Broccoli, well, I'm not so keen. Sprouts are boring and make me mean. In reality, most kids really don't like these vegetables, at least at first. But a recent study conducted on rats suggests that trying more bitter foods changes proteins in saliva that affect how we perceive the taste of food. Now, here's how that study was done. Two water bottles were filled with different tasting solutions.
Rats were made to choose from two bottles of liquid, one bitter and one sweet. Some of the rats were genetically modified with activated salivary proteins, akin to those who had been raised on a diet of bitter foods.
Those rats with the bitter-induced salivary proteins turned on couldn't taste the bitterness at higher concentrations when compared to others that didn't have the same protein activated. So once these proteins are on board, the bitter just tasted like water.
This suggested that repeated exposure to bitter foods can change the proteins in saliva, essentially calming the initial distaste for bitter and other flavors.
If we could convince people to try broccoli greens and bitter foods, they should know that with repeated exposure, they'll taste better once they regulate these proteins. Again, at least according to these researchers. I'll let you make up your mind. So our palates appear to be able to adapt to the foods we're given with repeated exposure.
Experts say repetition and engaging picking eaters into the cooking process are surefire ways to help change the minds or at least the saliva of stubborn eaters.
We know that there are several factors like genetics, culture, environment, and upbringing that play a role in developing our palates. Of course, it goes without saying that the earliest influence could be our mother's milk. As we grow into childhood, our developing brains prefer foods with energy return and replenishment, like sugars and salts.
If you are trying to get your child to try a new food, see if you can get him to try one new taste each week. Then see if you can get him to try it 10 or more times before finally throwing in the towel.
We experience the world using our five senses: sight, smell, sound, touch, and taste.
We experience them best through complex foods, where taste is broken down even further into five more categories: sweet, sour, bitter, salt, and umami. A neurologist.
Whoa, tell everyone what umami is before we continue.
Okay, the flavor umami kind of corresponds to the flavor of glutamates, especially monosodium glutamate, kind of a meaty flavor.
Anyway, let's get back to the neurologist, Dr. Clifford Siegel, who says different flavors affect different parts of our brain. He believes the taste itself part plays less of an important role than sight or touch.
That makes it harder to teach such a small part of the brain to inherently like healthier foods lacking the sugar, caffeine, and salt the larger parts of our brains prefer.
The way to make our brains learn to like healthier foods would be to increase the flavors of these healthy foods to provide some other sensory enjoyment. You could add something to make it smell good, which would theoretically co-stimulate our vision centers. The point is to make sure it's not just a trick. It's to avoid gimmicks and marketing buzzwords from companies that want to sell you nutrients in a bottle and consume them as a naturally packaged deal.
So just eat the plants. Bundle together everything in foods like broccoli and kale have been proven to give the human body the essential nutrients it needs. The important part is eating all of them together in their original packaging.
Now, that's not burger wrappers or powdered shakes, nor is it a fad diet or a 30-day challenge. Earlier this year, Gardner and his team published a study that tested low-fat versus low-carb diets in adults with obesity.
The study found neither was good for everyone, but people who ate a mix of vegetables and whole grains while avoiding sugar and refined grains had the most success.
Let's go over that last part, as it is the most important. People who ate a mix of vegetables and whole grains while avoiding sugar and refined grains had the most success. And that's mostly because personal and cultural differences affect our palates as well as our metabolism. We have to bring joy back to food. Part of that isn't only the foods we choose, but how we choose to behave around food.
Make sure that all the family is involved in making meal preparation, including the children. Have them participate and get their opinion known. It's a great way to get them to try foods that they do not generally like.
There is one problem with mass-produced food, even though it may taste good. Overall, it's killing us. Trying to eat more broccoli, however, won't kill you, even if your taste buds initially think that it will. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. These now include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, cancer, Crohn's disease, epilepsy, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, seizure disorders, chronic muscle spasms, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease, PTSD, a terminal condition, as well as other ailments and conditions, including certain diseases with chronic or long-term pain. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We've also set up a website for our Medical Marijuana Society at www.medmarsoc.com. That's www.medmarsoc.com. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. You can also set up an appointment for an office visit to Southside Medical Center right on the website. Again, that website is CompassionateCareJax.com.
HeyDoc.com.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.